Thank you very much. Thanks for having me here this afternoon. Obviously, I've got the difficult time spot of being between you and cocktails. So, in acknowledging that, I'd actually like to start with a DVD. Now, rest assured, it is a weekday and it is the afternoon and you're about to see Oprah. But I can assure you, it is related to what we're going to talk about today.
So all of you who are out there in the middle of nowhere and you're not going to get to Neiman's or Saks, you can go to rachelroy.com to find out where you can get Rachel's things. Rachel Roy, not to be confused with the one that cooks, okay? Where can you get a massage, a gourmet lunch, workout, and a haircut? Sounds like a resort or spa. It is not. It is the company that Fortune magazine just named the best place to work in the United States of America. Check this out.
I think Google was voted the best company because we go to amazing lengths to create the best possible work environment we can for employees.
In 1996, Stanford PhD students Larry Page and Sergey Brin set out to revolutionize how we find information on the web.
Google's first home was my garage, and they were there for about 5 months.
It took only 4 years for Google to become one of the biggest internet success stories in history.
We have kind of a mantra of don't be evil, which is to do the best things that we know how for our users, for our customers, and for everyone.
The company is now worth about $150 billion and has more than 10,000 employees worldwide.
There are definitely a lot of geeks here. It's a really positive place for geeks. Geeks enjoy being with other geeks. The Googleplex is a country in and of itself.
Along with the work are some eye-popping perks you don't see every day. 11 different cafeterias serve up gourmet food.
We love it. We love it. Having great food here makes such a difference. It enables us to be more productive. All the food is free. All the snacks are free. All the drinks are free. Everything is free.
There is a state-of-the-art gym, a lap pool, and other fun games.
Get to work around 9:30, see if anybody wants to play volleyball. Come out here at 10:30. In between, do some work.
Want to brush up on your French or Chinese?
We have foreign language classes, and if you need to know another language that we don't offer, that's something people can feel empowered to create and add.
At Google, dogs are welcome.
I usually bring my dog to work about 4 days, 4 times a week, and she sits in my office with me.
Employees can also take advantage of the company's laundry room or drop off their dry cleaning on site. There's even a concierge.
Let's say we need temp tickets to go somewhere, someone's looking for a specific restaurant, or really almost anything, you can ask the concierge service.
Need a haircut, your teeth clean, daycare, or a quick checkup from the doctor? If you work at Google, you can take care of all of that too. Salaries are competitive, and many staffers hit the jackpot and became millionaires thanks to company stock.
I feel like this is a little part of home for me.
I love working at Google. It's the next best thing to probably not working at all.
That's fantastic. Wow. The folks at Google told us, I know because everybody wants to now work there, they told us they receive 1,300 resumes a day. Yeah, go Google.
Anyone want to work for Google? Now, I show you this video not because NAB's about to announce chefs, concierges, or anything of the like, more to acknowledge that there is fierce competition globally to attract and retain talent. And I always find it interesting with some of my colleagues with competitor companies who say, look, I'm just not quite sure the war for talent's come. We haven't really noticed it. And I'm not sure if they're waiting for a literal war, but certainly in NAB we've started to notice it, probably subtly, but it's starting to move at a fairly rapid pace. And I always like this quote, the war for talent's over, talent's actually won. I'm going to talk through a fairly candid reflection of where NAB's at. It's certainly not a situation where I'm going to stand up in front of you and say, we've cracked this nut, we're doing everything possible in this workforce planning space. In many ways, given the complexities of our organisation, we're about 12 months into this journey and we've certainly got a long way to go. So very happy to take any discussions offline post the presentation today. I thought it'd be interesting to give you an understanding of the Australian banking landscape and how it's going to impact the workforce for us going forward. So we're the third largest sector in our economy. Globally, we're expected to grow at the rate, I'm told, by Ernst & Young of about 7.1%. And that actually equates to something in the trillions for those of you who aren't financially inclined like myself. Clearly, with growth comes increased competition, and that's at a local level and an international level. So to give you an idea, we've got 55 authorised banks in Australia, of which 41 are foreign-owned. Offshoring and outsourcing, it's predicted by 2008, one-third of banks will actually be doing some sort of offshoring and outsourcing, and that's certainly been high on our agenda at NAB. Obviously, a huge community expectation regarding corporate social responsibility. And that's a really difficult thing for a company like a bank. So I'll talk how we've started to address some of that. Greater focus on flexible initiatives in the workplace, a bit of an obvious one. Impact of globalisation. So clearly we're now in a market where talent is at a global level. It's not just looking at Australia. And increased voluntary turnover in the banking sector. I found that one interesting. It's actually anticipated, again, by Ernst & Young, that the banking sector turnover will actually rise over the next 10 years. We haven't started to see that a lot, not that our turnover isn't at a level where we need to keep an eye on it, but they're certainly predicting that to grow. So if we add to this some of the broader pieces that our previous speakers have alluded to today, so I won't go into a whole lot of detail, but clearly the ageing population is going to have huge impacts on all of our organisations. The demographic and cultural shifts in the workplace, the social criticism against some of the corporate activity, I think APAC in Sydney is a good example at the moment, increased global labour and talent markets, and greater pressure for companies like NAB, and a lot of the others to actually act on some of the broader global issues such as climate change, which is one of the obvious ones at the moment. So, in effect, demand is not actually going to meet supply. So our expected growth is being met with increased turnover and retirement in our workforce. So, for us specifically, what that actually means is critical skill shortages in the areas of financial planning, business banking, customer service, and sales roles. Now, to give some meaning to you for that, that's the bulk of our workforce. That's actually how we make most of our money. So some huge concerns for us, particularly where we're starting to notice it at the moment, is actually in the customer service and sales roles. So we've got some real skill gaps there. So we do have people sitting in those roles, but they're certainly not at a skill level that we would hope. So at the moment, we're choosing to take a person on a seat rather than leave the role vacant. So you'll see there, we're estimated to have supply shortages of somewhere in the vicinity of 195,000 by the end of the decade. I think it's really difficult when we talk in stats like that to actually comprehend what it means when we take it back to the workplace. So what I'm really keen to talk to you about is what this actually means for NAB, and how we're starting to address some of these issues. Now, most of you will be familiar with NAB, hopefully in a positive way, but I think it's important just to share with you some of the challenges that we've got. So we have 40,000 employees globally. Some 24,000 of those employees sit within the Australian region. So we contribute some 70% to the NAB Group's overall profit. We operate, as I said, predominantly in Australia, New Zealand, UK, and smaller outfits in Asia, probably likely to expand at some point, and very small in the US. We've got approximately 10 million customers, market cap in the vicinity of around $57 billion, and through partnerships with the likes of Australia Post, we have some 4,400 physical locations for customers to bank with us, so hence the reliance back on those service and sales-related roles. Now, I'm reluctant to almost bring this up, but most of you would be aware of the foreign exchange issues, I can say lightly, that we had some 3-4 years ago. So I've heard some murmurs already in the room. And I think it's important to address that because in many ways, whilst that was something that clearly as a company, it wasn't on our strategic agenda, it actually, in some ways, was of benefit to us. Outside of, we clearly rightly so, received some bad publicity around it. But what it did highlight for our organisation is we needed to get back to the people side of things. Our focus had been very much on performance, and performance almost at all costs. And what this actually did is highlight the behaviours, so the people side. So in many ways, that disaster, as some refer to it, has actually gave us the mandate in the HR area to start focusing back on our people initiatives and actually getting a greater investment in them. So our board is continuing to be very interested around our behaviours of our people, as is our regulatory body, APRA. So as I say, looking at what the opportunity was from a very negative situation, I think in many ways it's actually been a positive. Our internal world. I said I'd be quite candid, and I will. We're a large organisation with a very strong transformation agenda. Now, you can substitute the word transformation with restructure, if you like. But we've got numerous restructures, people moves and exits. To give you a sense of that, in the 05-06 year, we had some 40,000 moves in our Australian business in a 12-month period. 40,000 moves. Over that time, I think we had individuals that had three roles in the space of 12 months. That's not good for skill development. We had engagement and satisfaction scores that left a lot to be desired, and I'm very happy to say that we've just announced a 10% shift on both of those coming off last year, so we're certainly moving in the right direction. But a really poor history of talent management. I think in the past, we've focused all our energy on spreadsheets. I don't know if other organisations have kind of fallen into this trap, but lots of spreadsheets, lots of succession planning, replacement planning basically, but not a lot of time spent out providing tangible opportunities for our talented employees. We've actually lacked a fair bit of control in the investment of our people. So again, we have situations where our CEO would ask for an FTE figure. How many full-time employees do we have in the organisation? I'm happy to say this doesn't happen today. Now, he would ask three people that, and he actually got seven different answers back. Now, that's a pretty basic statistic, isn't it? We couldn't answer that. Again, not happening today. For our employees, it's actually very difficult for them, and I'm sure, Rod, if you don't mind me saying, it is a difficult thing with a large workforce to provide and help your employees actually navigate what their career could look like and also give some realistic insight into how their skills match or otherwise to specific roles. We've had a fairly confusing reward system. So similar to Rod, we see remuneration as hygiene factor. But in many ways, we haven't been able to actually tell a story of the positive things we're doing in the reward space. And even as a relatively new employee coming in, I found it somewhat difficult to understand what my long-term incentives were and my short-term incentives, et cetera, et cetera. So we've had some work to do there. Quite surprisingly, we didn't onboard our employees. So in terms of induction and orientation, that pretty much relied on the strength, or otherwise, of your people leader. There was no formal way that we actually introduced our employees into the organisation. It's probably baffling for most people sitting in the room. I was actually very surprised coming in. And just a systems piece is we've actually, just coming back to that point of FTEs, is that we'd struggled in the past around there's been no single source of the truth. So we've had very disparate technical platforms, particularly in the people space. So I think we've sort of grappled whether to go with, putting all our eggs in the SAP basket or actually doing a best of breed type approach to cover off talent management. And I'll talk how we've started to make some changes there. So whilst that sounds like a very negative story, I suppose you can say it was. And essentially the way we view it is that we never spent time to actually articulate what the people story was for NAB. And the way we sort of describe that is that when it comes to annual report time and people will prepare 3-6 months in advance to do their little piece in the annual report, the day before that report would be due, our EGM of it's called People and Organisational Development, of HR, would get a note saying, can you give us a few lines about the people stuff? And that was it. And I think that for us was a really good test that things actually need to change. So I'm going to talk through how we've started to address it. As I've said, it's not a perfect world that we're living in, but I think we've made some really good momentum. And the key to that being that we've actually looked at this skills shortage issue and workforce planning through a talent lens. It's pretty simple. You would have heard the likes of Apple speak about the talent factory. And whilst we don't use the word factory, it's very much about creating a talent mindset in our business. And that's not done through HR. So what we're really pushing, and we've been doing this for 12 months now, is pushing that our people leaders, our participants, so our talented employees, are actually the ones driving talent management. So we would have a situation in NAB when I first sort of came down to the region and was looking after, and we might lose one of our talented employees, and I would get a phone call and say, Kylie, why have we lost John Smith? I've never met John Smith, I couldn't tell you. But because I was in charge of talent, that was my responsibility. So again, some pretty strong mindset shifts that we needed to make around the talent space. In many ways, we had a lot of fixing to do. So the way I describe the process that we've gone through is actually to fix our respective specialist areas. And by that, I'm referring to talent, performance, reward, recruitment, diversity, all of those things that we all have in our organisations to greater and lesser degrees. And we've spent sort of 6 to 12 months actually getting our house in order and really getting them to a point where we think that they are leading edge in most cases in terms of what we can offer. Now, that in itself at NAB is not good enough, because what you can actually do by fixing your respective specialist areas is create more confusion for your employees. Because all of a sudden, because I fix talent, I want to go out and tell my employees that I fix talent. And so does my colleague in reward. And so we all end up basically touching, for want of a better word, employees without actually having a seamless approach so that their experience is seamless. Okay, so that's the point there around the integration. And I'd say we're just at that integration point now before we move into the embedding piece. And as I say, embedding is actually getting our employees to tell the story rather than our HR to tell the story. One of the key things that we made a commitment to do is actually in the leadership space. Now, most organisations absolutely have leadership programs. We have core leadership programs at different career transition points throughout the organisation. We decided to make a pretty strong investment in some core talent programs. So for our critical talent employees, so sorry if that sounds crude, but it's a terminology we use in NAB. One of those programs is called Accelerate. And we spent some time designing, and it might be a bit brash of me to say, but what we think is one of the country's leading programs in that space. And I'll talk a little bit about why we think that's important. But that was a real flagship program for us and a real turning point to our employees that we're actually starting to do something in this space. And it's starting to create a culture of meritocracy and one of aspiration. In doing that, we're very conscious that I think, what's the latest stat? 70 to 75% of people that leave organisations leave because of their direct manager. Okay? And so what we've done with all of our programs is incorporate a capability uplift for the people leaders of participants. And that's been a really strong... that's been really positively received for us, and we're starting to notice the difference. Aligned with the core capability, we've gone back and actually invested in some in-house capability programs around some of the skill gaps that we had. So lending, some of our credit, risk, sales, customer service, and that's something that's evolving over time, and I think we'd add to that Six Sigma, Lean, that type of capability development. We've taken things such as reward, which, as I said, there was a good story to tell there. We just didn't quite know how to make it a story, and we've just rebadged things. We've actually taken a branding lens over some of the people initiatives that we've got. So it's born out of that has born two concepts, my lifestyle and my career. And so taking something in the vicinity of 53 different initiatives and actually just badging it as my lifestyle. The employees are saying, about time, we could have told you this a long time ago. But what we've done is we've spent a lot of time and energy and money with the branding side of things, and we're getting some really positive feedback. The other commitment that we've made, and given that we're a large organisation, it's always difficult to strike that balance between do you try and touch as many individuals as you can with some of these core programs, or do you go for more of the quality conversations? And we've hopefully reached some sort of balance, obviously keeping in mind our resources. And we've made a commitment to high-touch conversations. And that, at the moment, is through HR, and it is also through people leaders who are capable of having those conversations. So I think, you know, I'll be honest in saying that one of the development areas for our organisation as a whole is the ability for people leaders to have difficult conversations, and they actually see conversations with our talented employees as being quite difficult. They're just not quite sure what they should be saying. So I can only imagine what they think about having conversations with our poorer performers. So we've got some work to do there as well. What I've mentioned is very much about our internal world. And most people sort of nodding, go, yeah, that sounds right. What we've been really conscious of for the last 3 years, actually, is our external market. So I'm going to park recruitment to the side just for a second. And we've partnered with an organisation for the last 3 years that strategically and proactively maps, and I'll be, again, honest, our competitors in the marketplace. So we define who our competitors are. We define the critical roles for our organisation globally, and we ask them to go away and on a regular basis keep us in touch with what our competitors are doing in the market, what candidates we should be keeping an eye on, and sometimes following that through to recruitment. So that's both the risk mitigation piece. It's got some cost efficiencies for recruitment, and believe you me, we need them. We spend somewhere in the order of $250 million to $300 million on recruitment each year. That does include a contractor base, but I don't think you need to be Einstein to realise that that's a little bit high. So that's something we've been doing that's very proactive, very strategic, and actually helped us in being able to target and then attract some very high calibre individuals at a global level into our organisation. I suspect this may be true of most large corporates, but we've had a very hierarchical view of talent. So you were talent if you reported into Amit, our CEO. And I wouldn't say we're there yet, but what we've done is really trying to move away from that mould and start to look at some of our customer-facing roles and identify them as critical roles. And similar to Rod's point, put some success profiles around that. What does success actually look like in those roles? How do we assess individuals to move into those roles? And where possible, how do we develop specific and targeted development programs to transition some of our key talent into those roles? So the concept of succession planning for us has moved very much away from the world of replacement planning. We don't spend our time on it. It is, in our opinion, a waste of time. And we've moved to the concept of talent pools. So pools of individuals that are feasibly capable of moving into critical roles in our business. And we've done that through the design and implementation of a global talent management system. So that's our technical enabler to make that happen. So no more spreadsheets, no more sticky notes. It's a good thing. Something, and I think I was having a conversation earlier about our graduate focus. That had been in decline for us. So if we think about Gen Y, et cetera, our reputation in the graduate market some 18 months, 2 years ago was pretty poor. So we've reinvested back in that, and we're now attracting in excess of 200 graduates a year, and that's something that will continue to be a focus for us. We've introduced things such as reverse mentoring, give our graduates a bit of a say, help those Gen Ys with all their opinions, and also try and bridge the gap a little bit with some of our senior employees. So it's been an interesting journey around the reverse mentoring. We're starting to talk, and these arrangements certainly aren't done. We've started to talk with some of our feasibly competitors in the international market to see if we can look at setting up some cross-organisational exchanges so that we can actually facilitate our employees to gain global experience or just different experience outside of NAB, somehow, I suppose, have some positive way of bringing them back into the NAB brand. So that's some discussions that we're in at the moment, obviously it's not easy. There's a whole lot of our risk people are right over this one. But we think that's a really positive way to start to look at the skills shortage and attracting and retaining people on a global level. One thing we haven't been very good at is actually just taking a risk. So what we're very conscious of is you put someone on this fantastic development program, then you've got to do something with them when they come off. So 12 months, you've actually raised that individual's skill, you've raised their perspective, and now they have greater expectations of what you're going to do with them in terms of their career moving forward. So the true test, in my mind, of talent management is not how great the leadership programs are, is what you do with individuals when they come off those programs. And something that we're working really hard on in the background, we've got about 6 months until our first group roll off the talent programs, is actually moving them around on a global basis and getting our EXCO, executive committee, very comfortable with that. Just a quick mention around the sort of external marketing piece. So diversity and flexible work practices. I think it's interesting when we sit back and look at some of our competitors, what they seem to do really, really well is market the things that they're doing. And our normal response is, we're doing that, but we're not actually telling anyone about it. So I think we'll see some shift there as well. The other thing we're very conscious of is the great world of HR. We love it. It's the warm and fuzzy for some people out there, but for those of us in it, it's great. You know, and we establish our people agenda, but often we forget to align it to other agendas in the organisation. So one thing that we're working very closely, this is just a recent thing for us, is to actually almost morph, if you like, the people side with the strategy and marketing side so that we have joint agendas and we're not just HR sitting as an isolated function. So it sounds simple, but there is a very distinct difference as to the way we've been operating in the past to how we hope we operate in the future. Conscious of time. If we get the people leadership right, we get some of these initiatives right, we're very, very aware that our employees can be the best advocates. It's a pretty simple notion, yet a lot of organisations struggle with it, us included. And I just wanted to personalise one of the programs, this Accelerate program that I referred to, and just give you a sense of how you can create an experience for an individual that truly connects them with your brand, with NAB, at an individual level, at an organisational level, and a broader community level that goes far beyond, you know, the traditional sort of junket or chalk and talk type approach that we've all used or relied on in the development space. So this particular quote comes from one of our participants on our Senior Executive Talent Program. This program is a 12-month journey. It's this particular quote was just sent in by the individual after a week-long trip we had in Alice Springs. And the focus of that was to learn, I suppose, about ethics and values-based leadership in a highly complex and ambiguous environment such as what Alice Springs is facing at the moment in their Indigenous communities. So I just wanting to personalise and share it with you. The journey was significant and forced me into the uncomfortable position of challenging deeply entrenched beliefs. It shifted my paradigm of what's right and wrong, and I don't think I'll ever forget it. The time away allowed me to consider what accountability means from an organisational perspective, for the social consequences of its action or inaction. A new approach is needed to integrate social considerations more effectively into our core business operations and strategy. I am personally committed and feel galvanised into wanting to make a difference. Thank you very much.